Let it begin with me. All right. I came to a meeting here a few days ago. It was a big book study at noon, and we were talking about the spiritual malady, in the doctor's opinion, and on page 52, and there were some really, really solid comments going on in that meeting, and I felt like I fit in here talking about this stuff. I mean, you guys, it sounds like you're doing great. Everybody looks good. Most of the women have all their teeth. I mean, this is definitely a cool group. I remember when this group started, it was kind of a split off from some other groups, and it's really cool to see how it's grown and how everybody is just looking real good. I came to AA in 87. I was 23 years old. It was actually right before I turned 23. And I had been drinking solid since I was 11. Started drinking daily when I was about 12 years old. And the drinking was consumed so much of my time and energy that everything else fell by the wayside. School, relationships at home, you guys know the drill. And by the time I was 18, I had spent a total of 36 months in inpatient psychiatric hospitals. Because what they were doing is they were trying to treat the symptoms. You know, Tom, you need to be a good boy. You need to, be home at curfew. You need to, get along with others and all this other stuff. And every time I left one of those places, it was a matter of days or hours before I was drinking again. Of course, we didn't talk about alcoholism back then, especially with the kids, because I don't think the insurance companies were paying for adolescents to get drug treatment or alcohol treatment. So by the time I'm 19 years old, I'm out of the last place, and I'm living in Austin, Texas, which was pretty much the major scene of the crime for me. That's where things just went nuts, and there was all sorts of opportunities down there to just raise hell and fit right in and not really stand out too much. And by the time I was 22, everything just started to crumble. Everything stopped working. The booze, which was solving my problem, quit working. I was in a place where, I didn't want to drink. I didn't want to stop drinking. I wanted to drink more than I wanted to stop, but I needed to stop more than I needed to drink. And I was just a basket case. And I ended up going to this treatment center up in Chicago and went back to Austin after I got out. I grew up in Chicago, so after I got out of there, I went back to Austin and I started going to meetings. And I'll tell you, for the first few years, it was a blast. Went to some, fairly well-established groups down there, fairly large. And most of these meetings were discussion meetings where the chairman would pick a topic and sometimes we'd stay on it, sometimes we'd wander aimlessly from the topic. And a lot of times it turned into, I can relate to that, let me plug in my little story here, and then it just kind of goes around the room. And so you're listening for the solution, and what you're hearing is a bunch of people's problems. And for a while, I got to admit, I mean, there is, maybe I'm a voyeur or something, but some of this stuff was interesting to hear. I mean, some of you guys were just wacko. Seriously. And I would keep coming back just to listen to the next episode. And after 5 or 10 years of this, man, I'm starting to get real grindy. I'd kind of taken what I thought was the steps. If you had asked me if I'd taken the steps, I could say yes, because I did what my sponsor told me to do. However, what he told me to do didn't really even rhyme with what's in the big book. It was just kind of different exercises, a bunch of writing and reading on step one, reading and writing on step two, and we weren't following the directions out of the book. And so the results I got were pretty goofy. One place where we lose a lot of people in AA is with the God thing. I mean, who here hasn't come in a little goofy about the God issue? We all have, or most of us have. And I'm sitting here on step two, obsessed like crazy, all I can think about is getting loaded. And my sponsor's gotten me reading this thing about, in a book, in the chapter says step two. I've got to read it for 30 days. And if I miss a day, I got to start all over. So after 30 days, I lied and told him I made the 30 days. And I didn't believe in God like I was supposed to. That's what I was supposed to get out of this exercise. The problem was is we never started with step one. We never started with what the problem really was. You know, when I came to AA, I thought step one meant that I drink too much, and when I drink, bad stuff happens. I thought the bad stuff was the unmanageability in step one. And so that became my definition. That became my problem. And when I looked at it as my problem that way, the solution, the steps, didn't make a whole lot of sense. Because here I am, you know, I'm clear of the booze. I'm getting along with people, paying my bills, going to work. All the bad stuff that happened quit happening. And by that definition, my problem was solved, basically doing what I was doing. So I was perfectly okay with you know, going to 90 and 90 and 1,000 and 1,000 and doing, you know, going to playing sober softball and going to Denny's and doing all the fellowship stuff, because there was so much emphasis on the fellowship, on the activities, on the meetings, instead of the steps and God and working with others, at least at the groups I was going to, that it was real easy to kind of get caught up in that and think that that's what AA was. And we all know, you know, what happens with that. Most people that come to us, especially today, I don't know what the success rates are for sure. I know the numbers they're throwing around, and they're terrible. Most people coming to AA aren't making it, you know, 10% at best, but I think the number's lower than that. You guys probably might think so too from your own observations, watching people come and then wondering where the hell they are the next day. They're gone, and what happens is, what happened with them at our meetings is they came for the solution. They really wanted it. It's not like they weren't willing to go to any length. We just didn't give them anything to sink their teeth into. We told them to come back, everything will get better, put the plug in the jug, think through the drink, etc., etc., etc. And when these alcoholics came in and tried to do this stuff, most of them didn't make it. Anybody here ever killed a newcomer? One, two. Anybody ever have anybody die trying to stay sober on the advice that you gave them? I had a guy that came to me. We'd worked together at the Austin State Hospital. It was a combat zone. We were real tight. Every night we were wrestling or tackling and shackling, and you just kind of get real close to people when you're working in that kind of environment. And so I had about 5 years. I hadn't worked there in 5 years, and he calls me up and says, "Man, are you still in AA?" And I said, "Yeah." He says, "I need help. I have got to stop drinking." I said, "Well, come on, man. Let me pick you up. I'll take you to a meeting." And we go to this meeting, and I don't know what the topic was. It doesn't matter. But it turned out to be one of these, you know, complaining meetings where everybody was just kind of pissing and moaning about their problems. And we get in the car, and this guy just blasts me after the meeting. He's like, "You know, what in the hell was that all about?" I'm like, "What are you talking about?" He says, that meeting, those people, what's the matter with them?" I was like, "Nothing. What's the matter with you?" "Well, I mean, all they did was just, you know, bitch and moan, and they look like they're all ready to kill themselves." I said, "Man, you've got a messed up attitude." That's not quite how I said it. "But these people are sober and you're not. And you ain't going to make it with an attitude like that. If you're going to get mad at the people and dislike the people who are going to save your bacon, you ain't going to make it." So he goes to another meeting. Same thing. Goes to another meeting. Calls me up after that meeting. Says the same thing. This time he's getting more aggressive in his opinions and his comments. And we go to the mat over the telephone, and I pretty much, you know, tell him that he ain't going to make it if his attitude doesn't change. And a week later, Paul killed himself. And I didn't kill him. I know that. However, if I had been equipped with the right information to give this guy, with something of substance rather than telling him to, you know, go to 90 and 90 and put the plug through in the jug and think through the drink, he might have had a shot. If the whole group had been doing what it's supposed to do, carrying its message to the alcoholic who still suffers, instead of trying to work on our own problems, he might have heard something he could sink his teeth into, and he might have found a reason to take these steps. Nobody's going to do these steps if they don't have a reason to do it. And the main reason for doing it is to understand exactly what our problem was, which we never talked about in the groups I was going to. You know, when we say we're powerless over alcohol, we're talking about two things. We're powerless over choice, whether we can drink, whether we can choose not to drink, and control, how much we drink. I can't choose not to drink. I can't choose not to take the first drink, and I can't control how much I drink when I drink. And when you got a mind that can't keep you from the first one and a body that can't keep you from the second drink, you're going to die. And I didn't understand that as my problem because we didn't use the big book, basically, in all honesty. People didn't bring them to the meetings. We had some kind of tucked in a little basket in the corner in case a big book study broke out. And so, you know, you could just wander in and not have your big book and still be able to read the big book during the study. But if we understand that that's what our problem really is, and we understand that if we don't have power and we need power to stay sober, and that's exactly what these steps are designed to do. I thought the steps were all about, you know, turning Tom into a good boy and helping me, you know, play well with others and kiss and make up with everybody and all this other garbage, because that's kind of how it was presented to me. You know, if you get depressed, work the steps. If you're getting divorced, do the steps. If this is happening to you, do the steps. It wasn't anything about if you don't want to ever drink again for the rest of your life, forever, do the steps. It was never presented like that. It was always presented as a solution to a current problem. And if I'm not having any major current problems, I'm not going to do these steps. I remember I had like 15 years, and I was in a meeting. It was a men's meeting. I don't know what the topic was. It doesn't matter. But when you have 15 years, you know you're going to get called on. And sure enough, they called on me. They thought I might have something to say when, you know, the best I could do for 15 years is maybe make people laugh a little bit and throw some BS out there. And, you know, we could all tiptoe through the tulips together. But I never had anything of substance. And this time I had nothing. I hadn't spent the time that I should have been spending preparing what I was going to say in the event that I got called on. And of course, when the topic changes every time someone talks, you gotta change what you're gonna say, and you know, you wanna relate to this guy and you wanna relate to this guy, and it's all about relating to everything. And I was just there. I was like, I gotta be honest with you guys. I feel like I'm gonna drink again, and I don't think it's gonna be today or this month or this year. I don't know when it's coming, but I'm on this track. And I can feel it, and I can't derail this train. I can't make a shift. And these, I mean, these are my friends. I'm not knocking these people. All we did with each other is shared with us, with other people, what was shared with us. Just like everybody in AA is doing. There's nothing. Nobody means any harm. Everybody means the very best for everybody. But the advice was kind of man-made and not big book made, not based on any real experience. And so they came up and suggested that I start coming early and making the coffee and doing other stuff, doubling up on my meetings. And I'm thinking, you know, if I gotta double up in these open depression meetings, I'm gonna die. If that's the answer to this, I'm dead. And a couple of years later, the thought came into my head, and I had plenty of time to think about the consequences, to think about everything that ever happened before I got to the program, all the bad stuff, all the, you know, going to jail, writing bad checks, et cetera, all of these jams that we seem to get into. There's no way in hell I wanted to go back to that stuff. And this time I had done a really good job at putting the outside part of my life together. You know, I'd gone to, you know, UT, got a bachelor's and master's, had my own business, was making decent money, great wife, great kid, no triggers, nothing bad is going on, no issues, no nothing. So, you know, here I am for 17 years looking out for these triggers, and there aren't any, and that thought comes into my head, and I start playing these tapes. And I start thinking about what will happen if I drink. And in spite of everything that I thought about, and I think I was pretty accurate, except for the dying part, I drank anyway. And I was absolutely, completely shocked that all the advice that I had heard in AA for so many years didn't work. You know, I played the tape through as well as anybody could play it through. I could remember everything. I could predict what would happen. And it didn't work. I never quit going to meetings. My meeting attendance was, at that time, it was about 2 or 3 a week because it's all I could take. But I never had any spots where I wasn't going to meetings. I was doing what I was told to do, and it failed. And when I got, you know, when I finally got sober again, I met some people who understood the big book and how to work this program out of the book. And when I started studying this thing, my eyes started to open up. And I got news for you. There's a lot of stuff that they didn't tell us about AA. I thought that I pretty much had heard everything and seen everything that could possibly be seen or heard in the program. And we missed a lot of stuff, the people that came before us. On page 24 in the big book, and if you have a book at home, I would encourage you to go home and pick out this paragraph and underline it, paint it yellow, cut it out, tape it to your mirror, something. This is the money shot in the big book right here. We're talking about the mental obsession. This is on page 24. The first part of the book, the doctor's opinion, first 23 pages, is all about the physical part of the disease, the allergy, the phenomenon of craving. When I put booze in my body, I trigger a physical craving for more alcohol. I could never just go out and have 6, 7, or 8 drinks, which I didn't think was asking too much, and stop. I could never do it. I could never go out and get drunk and then go home, get up, go to work the next morning, pay my bills, all this other stuff. I always drank until I passed out, or I fell asleep, or I ended up in handcuffs, or I ran out. Some of your housewives are good. I mean, you guys drink NyQuil and Listerine. I never thought of that stuff. Otherwise, you know, I never would have run out. I would have just gone down to Safeway or Skaggs or whatever grocery store is nearby and kept drinking all night. That's what happens when I put booze in my body. That phenomenon, that craving, does not occur in normal drinkers. It does not occur. It separates us from the rest of the crowd. If we're going to talk about what it is to be an alcoholic, we need to boil out the stuff that isn't an alcoholic. Okay? That's one of the things that separates us from the other 90% or whatever that don't seem to have caught the genetic bullet. So when I put booze in my body, I crave booze. The answer to the craving is don't drink. If you don't put alcohol in your body, you cannot physically crave it. Can't happen. After 2 or 3 days, 4 days, 5 days, we're detoxed, the physical craving is gone. My problem is, though, is I can't keep from picking up that first drink and triggering that craving. I've got this mental disorder, this malady that prevents me from being able to stay sober for any length of time on thinking through the drink or playing the tapes through or all this other stuff. It says that the fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. What this is telling me is that you know, put the plug in the jug and think through the drink is bullshit a swear word? It's erroneous. It doesn't work for real alcoholics. How did I stay sober? Couldn't tell you. I couldn't write a book about it. And if I could, I wouldn't suggest you copy what I did. I don't know. The truth is when I trust my mind to keep me sober, when I go through these exercises, I pull out my little trigger list or you guys know what I'm talking about, it ain't going to help me stay sober. The first time around, I was too far away from the last drink by the time we started talking about the steps to feel enough pain to do the work. Okay? This time I wasn't. Last time I knew that if I kept going, dying was a possibility. This time around, I knew that dying was around the corner. And I was pretty messed up. I mean, all my hope was gone. You know, after I relapsed, I had gone back to my old meetings. You know, I tried to get sober again. And people avoided me. Not because they were rude, I don't think. But I think because they didn't know what to say. I think that's probably most of it. The ones that did speak up said something like, well, man, sure glad you've been out there doing research for me. And, you know, I'm glad to see that it's not any good anymore. Well, wait a minute. The suffering alcoholics are supposed to carry the message into the room? Is that the deal? We're so selfish that we're gonna try to stay sober on somebody else's story? This paragraph is telling me I can't stay sober on my own damn story. What makes me think that my story is going to keep anybody else sober? Or that their story is going to keep me sober? Our drunkologues and war stories are appropriate when we're meeting somebody for the first time and we're exposing them to the program. But once they're here, that time is over. They're here to hear some solution. And what I heard was, you know, keep coming back, put the plug in the jug, you know, thanks for doing my research for me, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, oh, I'm dead. I'm going to die from this thing. And I really believed that. I believed that what I had experienced for 17 years was AA. And then if I went back to that, I was going to die. And I didn't have any hope of anything else until I found these guys that were studying the book and they showed me this stuff. They showed me exactly what my problem was in step one. Can't keep myself from the first drink. Can't keep myself from the second or 15th. And it goes on and on and on. And there's nothing I can do without a power greater than myself to get sober. You know, I told you I thought that the steps were all about turning me into a good boy. It's got nothing to do with that. The steps are designed to be worked quickly, in a week or two. And they're designed to remove everything that's blocking me from that power. The selfishness, self-centeredness, fear, resentment. They're designed to identify and tease out those things that are blocking me from that power that I have to have if I'm going to live. And that's what these steps are all about. So when they were put to me in that light, it kind of made sense that, you know, this is the solution. Lack of power is my problem. Power is my solution. I got a bunch of stuff blocking me from my solution. We got to do some work to get that stuff unblocked. And then I'm good. I'm golden. And it worked. I mean, I took these steps in 12 days. I started sponsoring a guy when I had 3 weeks. I wish he was still sober so I could brag about him some more. But, you know, he wasn't done. He just wasn't done. But it's not because he didn't have somebody that knew how to take him through the work and how to explain to him what his problem was. And from that point on, I've been out doing all sorts of stuff that I never thought I would do. I always thought, you know, I did detox meetings and treatment center meetings my first 3, 4, 5 years, and I had a good time, and I would go and I'd make them smile and pass out chips and all this other stuff. But after a few years of that, my thinking is, well, you know, shoot, we'll just let these new guys do it. You know, it's their turn. You know, let them, you know, cut their teeth on this stuff. I'll sit back, and if a newcomer wanders into the meeting, well, I'll take up a chair, and that way I can say I'm doing 12-step work because the newcomer has to see someone here to get some hope. And so that was my cop out for what I was doing. That's you know, my dishonesty. I knew I wasn't doing much. I knew I was skating by in the bare minimum, and part of doing the bare minimum is not doing anything else. And I just kind of got comfortable with that stuff, and started doing that stuff, and started lying to myself about what it was to carry this message. You know, giving people my phone number, telling them to call me, all this other stuff. And if they called, I mean, I didn't know what to say to them anyway, but they didn't call. You know, most of them don't call. Unless you got some kind of strong message that makes them want to have what you have. But nobody wanted what I had. I had nothing to offer them. Yeah, I was talking about how a lot of emphasis has been placed on the fellowship. And I don't want to knock the fellowship part, because I've got some great friends. Big book thumpers, non-big book thumpers, you know, whatever, in AA. People that I've been friends with for 20 years that I still talk to. All my buddies in Austin that are still around, I talk to them a bunch. I see them when I go down there, and I cherish these relationships. However, I think one of our problems, one of the ways we could improve things, is if we back off the fellowship part and maybe going more a little more into the program part of the deal, so that when these new people come, they've got something to hear besides, you know, come play poker with us, or let's go do this, or let's go do that. How about let's go take these steps? You can have a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps, and you can have the coolest life you ever imagined. You know, the coolest thing in the world is to take a guy from square one, just shaking and vibrating in his shoes, and going through this work and watching them over 7 days, 8 days, 9 days completely change to where, you know, day one they're just hopeless, and on day 10 or 15 they're like, I gotta go to a detox meeting and tell some people about this stuff. You can't shut these guys up when they go through the work and get that experience. I thought I had the experience. I thought that, you know, because I did the third step prayer every day that I was golden. I thought that's all I had to do. And we all know from, you know, most of us from our own experience, that prayer isn't enough. If prayer worked so well, most of us wouldn't need AA. Most of us would have prayed our way into sobriety, but it doesn't work like that. It's the action that we have to take through the steps. You know, in the foreword to the second edition, it's kind of funny. It took me 18 years in the program to realize that our fellowship is named after a book. The basic text of AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, were named after this book. It says they're going through the history of the first edition of the book, and they're talking about the membership had reached about 100 men and women. The fledgling society, which had been nameless, now began to be called Alcoholics Anonymous from the title of its own book. So we got this fellowship named after a book. Call me crazy, but we should be doing what's in the book. The fellowship should be based on what's in the book and not all these other little techniques and devices to stay sober for a 24-hour period. You know, what we've done is we've designed little gimmicks and little tricks to help people stay sober for 24 hours instead of staying sober for good and all. And that's where we get things get a little dicey, and we start to lose people, because, you know, we tell them, okay, now wake up at, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning, say your third step prayer, call me, call your sponsor, and then you can make it to a noon meeting. That's 1 hour. You won't drink. You can go to lunch with everybody afterwards. In fact, a bunch of them go to Luby's. You can go and get a really great deal on the Luann platter, and you can sit around and fellowship till about 2:30. Go home, take a nap. That'll kill a couple hours. Then you can get up, have dinner. That'll kill an hour. Then you can make it to an 8 o'clock meeting. And if you really want to be part of us, well, you got to go to Denny's with us afterwards. And we'll sit there until 10:30, 11 o'clock, drinking coffee, pissing off the waitress because she quit making money on us, you know, 2 hours ago. And then all you got to do is drive home, thank God for keeping you sober, go to sleep, and do it all over again tomorrow. And we'll have all sorts of tricks for you to stay sober for a 24-hour period. what a tough way to do this thing. I mean, that's hard. That's real hard. You know, one of the things that happened with us is we quit qualifying people to see if they're real alcoholics. And you know, we're in this age of, we don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. We don't want to say anything tough or controversial. We want everybody to feel comfortable. Somehow we got it in our minds that it's better to love someone to death than to piss them off a little bit and help them get to God as quick as possible. But that's what I did. And that's what, you know, people around me did. Is, you know, we wouldn't say anything. We'd let someone sit in one of our meetings and talk and talk and talk about some selfish, self-centered stuff when we know in the book that the selfishness and self-centeredness has to get removed or we die. If this stuff doesn't get removed, we're going to drink again, and to drink is to die. But we're allowing these people to engage in something that could kill them. They're not focused on anybody else. They're not focused on the newcomer. They're not focused on other people. They're focused on themselves. And to allow people to do this for years and years is really kind of a disservice. You know, sponsors, friends, you know, talk to these people. Point them towards the steps. Point them towards God. One of the biggest kept secrets in AA is that we can't work on ourselves. Countless people come in and I hear them talking in the meetings. They're talking about, I'm working on myself, I'm working on my character defects, I'm working on this, I'm working on this. The book's real clear that we can't remove this stuff ourselves. We can't do it, but we spend all sorts of time trying. The truth is, if we take these steps and we have this psychic change, this spiritual awakening, if you will, and focus on helping others get to it, God fixes all that stuff. But nobody believes it because they don't try it. They're still kind of stuck on this notion that, you know, AA is a self-help group and we can come in and talk about our problems. And if we can talk about them enough, we won't have to drink over them. The truth is, we don't drink because of our problems. I don't drink because, you know, of my childhood or because my dad was a jerk or my mom had square nipples or, you know, that's a little pause for laughter. We don't drink over our issues. Otherwise, everybody that ever had a problem or an issue would be an alcoholic. We drink because being sober sucks. It's real clear. We drink because we are restless, irritable, and discontent. No matter what's going on, whether life is great or life is in the toilet, we are naturally dissatisfied, naturally unhappy. We never feel like we belong in the world. I mean, it's kind of like you know, you ever watch a dog do a couple laps on the carpet looking for just the best spot to sit down, and when he finally finds that right spot, he just drops and everything's okay. We're like that dog going around in circles, and we never find our spot unless we drink. If we drink, we can get okay. If we drink, we're not restless, we're not irritable, we're not discontent. It's when we don't drink that we see our alcoholism, the absolute self-absorption and just the need to arrange everything in our lives just the way we want them, only to find out that once we get everything the way we want them, it isn't what we wanted anyway. I could never get happy with anything. I always wanted to be doing something. And once I started doing it, it was never the right thing, and I'd go try to do something else. Not happy, not happy, not happy. I was always running around trying to get happy. And the only thing that ever fixed that was the booze. My problem is that my solution to my problem, the booze, turned into a really big problem. And, you know, when it quits working, we need to do something drastic like do these steps. You know, I remember being 22, 23 years old thinking, you know, this is a little drastic, this getting sober and going to AA and all this stuff. You know, was I really that bad? And, that, you know, that's how we think. We don't understand exactly what the real problem was. If I had understood what the problem was back then, I might be up here with 20 years today. Or maybe not, I don't know. However, if I had gotten the message when I came for the message, things could have turned out differently. Paul could still be alive. All sorts of things could have happened. There could be a lot of people that we love that we've seen go back out that could still be here with us today. You know, and trust me, it wasn't because they didn't want it. I didn't drink because I didn't want to be sober. I did want to be sober. I drank anyway because I had no defense. And these folks that come to us have no defense that lasts longer than a week or a month. So if what it says on page 24 is true, if we got a week or a month before we lose our defenses, we got a week or a month to get to this solution and get to it quickly. I'll be right back. Just like Dan and everybody else I've talked to in the program, most of us think that the steps take a long time because we were told they take a long time. That, you know, step one, you got to do some writing. Step two, you got to do some writing. Step three, well, when you're ready, we'll let you take step three because you got to believe in God before you take step three. Step four, depending on how old you are, it's going to be 40, 50, 60 pages. Do it early. You know, step five is going to be this 8-hour torture session. Step six and seven, well, I don't know if I want to remove everything, and so we just sit there. Eight and nine, you know, we think about making our amends. By the time we get to it, we're pretty much out of gas, and so, you know, going around and making amends isn't a very attractive proposition. And 10, 11, and 12, I can't do those because I haven't finished step nine. And so this was my understanding of how the work was done. And it wasn't presented in a very appealing manner. And it's not what it says in the book. In fact, it's a huge cry from what it says in the book. Step one is, like we read every meeting, is a pertinent idea. When I take a guy through the work, here, I'll just pick on someone, Jason. I actually took him through the work. We're going to sit down, and I'm going to go through the doctor's opinion in the first 43 pages. We're going to talk about this craving that we have and how it triggers a craving for more alcohol. We're going to talk about this mental obsession. You know, did you ever have a good reason not to drink and drink anyway? Yes. Have you done it a bunch? Oh, yeah. Do you think if you didn't get help, you could stop drinking on your own? No. Great. You're done with step one. Step two, where are you at with God? Like him, hate him. He's okay. Well, let me explain something to you. You know, if you take belief in God and put it on a 0 to 100 scale, where 0 is there ain't no God and 100 is I just play golf with him, you don't got to get to 100. I thought you had to get to 100. The way my sponsor was working with me, I had to get to 100 to move on to step three. You just got to believe that you can get to one. You don't even have to get off of zero. You got to believe that you can get off the mark. And if you can do that, you're in. You are in the club. You know, how it works, we read this every meeting. You know, God could and would if he were sought. It means if he were sought, not if he were found. I don't have to find God and believe in God 100% to take step three. I just got to take step three. I thought step three was just a little lip service, kind of like, hi God, I'm here too, help me. And step three is actually a pretty damn big deal. If you look at the words, it's a big deal that we're striking with God. You know, offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. We're pretty much offering everything to him, and he can do whatever he wants. You know, you're the driver. I'll ride shotgun. Whatever you say goes. Relieving you of the bondage of self, which on the previous pages we've determined can kill us. We're asking him to remove this thing that can kill us. And if you do that, I will better do your will. Take away my difficulties, which at this point isn't the booze. The booze is already gone by the time we're on step three. Now we're talking about our difficulties. And I would submit to you, and I know this is just gonna rub some people the wrong way, and I'm sorry, but what if what if some of this baggage we're carrying around, some of this regret, some of this self-pity from things that happened to us, some of these, you know, issues, abuse, incest, whatever, what if this stuff is a spiritual problem and can be removed by God? Just think about that. Wouldn't that be cool? What if this stuff is spiritual? What if, you know, I wasn't responsible for what happened to me when I was 5, but I'm damn sure responsible for carrying the resentment around for 38 years, and I used it to justify a lot of my bullshit behavior. What if this stuff is spiritual in nature? What if that stuff is the self-centeredness? Wouldn't it be cool if he would take that away? And all we have to do is bear witness to those you would help of his power, his love, and his way of life. Go tell everybody about it. How cool would that be? That's happened with me. I mean, that's what it's like to be me. I don't have any regrets about the past. Wish I had a different past, but good God, I mean, I use my past, my history, to carry this message. And it's turned into one of the biggest assets for me. Relapsing with 17 years sucks. And it's a real ego beating to cash in, you know, a 1987 sobriety date. And I hated that happening. However, there's no way in hell I would have gotten up at this lectern tonight and shared any of this stuff with you guys if I hadn't gone through that. And if I hadn't found some guys that understood how to do the work out of the book, the way the guys did it back in the 30s. When the success rates were through the ceiling. Cool? So maybe this stuff is spiritual in nature, and maybe it requires a spiritual solution. Just something to think about. I'm not saying, you know, go fire your therapist. I'm just asking you to look at the same thing in a different light and see what comes up. Maybe take it to God in prayer and meditation and ask Him to direct your thinking on this and see what comes out of it. If God can get us sober, He can fix a whole bunch of other stuff. We just got to trust that maybe He can. Most of us aren't there. I understand that. That's what we're doing in step 3. We're making a deal. God, you do this stuff for me, I'll do this stuff for you. And the way we get started on that is by taking the rest of the steps. So, you know, yeah, it is kind of a decision to take the rest of the steps, but we got to understand this is where we're telling God we'll go to any length. You do this, I'll do this. Cool? Step 4. Here's an example right here. You guys have all seen this, Mr. Brown. I kind of wish I was Mr. Brown. That guy seemed to be having quite a bit of fun without any real consequences except Bill Wilson hating his guts. You can use a legal pad. You can use a notebook paper. We've got these little worksheets that we use. If you do it like it's described in the book, it takes about an hour, maybe an hour and a half. This is not an exercise in uncovering all your dark little secrets and bringing them to the surface and sharing them and holding crystals and lighting incense and feeling all good about yourself. You know, that kind of stuff is really more of an exercise in self-centeredness than identifying our part in this stuff. What this step is designed to do specifically is to tease out the exact nature of your wrongs, which you're going to admit in step 5. We're not admitting the wrongs, we're admitting the nature of them. And the nature of them is going to be something like we were afraid, we were selfish, self-centered, inconsiderate of others, dishonest, whatever. That's the nature of our wrong. So when we go to step 5, what I do with guys is I take the 4th step out of their hands. I don't want them sitting there reading it to me because they're going to focus on the column 2 stuff, the reason for the resentment. And then we're just going to get all wrapped up in self. I'll read it to them and we'll do a few words on what happened so that I'm clear on what the deal is. And then we're going to talk about what they did, what their part in this deal was. And by the time we get done with step 5, they're going to be so sick with selfishness and self-centeredness that doing 6 and 7, becoming willing to have God remove that stuff and then asking Him to do it, is an absolute piece of cake. Step 6, the end of step 5 takes an hour. You go home, sit quietly for 60 minutes, review the work you've done, make sure you're cool with it, make sure you understand step 1, all this other stuff. Step 7 takes 11 seconds. It's just a prayer. It's just a prayer. Step 8, we made a list. We've got a lot of it from the 4th step. There might be some people that didn't get on there. I just have people write a separate list. List everybody you ever harmed. Then we get together, we go over it. We go over how to make the amends, how to never go in and say I'm sorry, because that's just lame. But how to restore these people, how to get them free. This is our first experience helping others, helping them get free of what we did to them. And that's the coolest feeling in the world. Step 10, a lot of us think we have to finish 9 before going on to 10. Page 84, it tells us something completely different. At the end of the promises, we've gone through the promises of step 9, then it says this thought, meaning that the promises will materialize if we work for them. This thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. We vigorously commence this way of living as we clean up the past. While we're making our amends, we start on step 10. And step 10 is where we lose half the fellowship because they won't follow these directions. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. That sounds like our fourth column from the inventory, from the four-step stuff, are the exact nature of our wrongs. We keep looking out for this. Just because you ask God to remove it in 6 and 7 doesn't mean that it ain't going to come back. This is where we catch it. And this isn't step 11, this is step 10. We continue to watch this. It's done continuously. And when they crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. We discuss them with someone immediately, not tomorrow, not next week, immediately, and make amends quickly if we have harmed anyone. Then we can resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Love and tolerance of others is our code. That means we're going to stop exerting our will in everything that we do and just kind of, you know, go with the flow, go with God's will rather than our will. But where we lose people is they think that their little resentments and their little episodes of dishonesty are too small to call us. And so they don't do it. I've got a guy right now that, you know, I just had a, what we'll call it, a talk about this stuff where he was deciding what's good enough to call about and what's not instead of what God's deciding. This book means what it says. And if it says to call when this stuff comes up, you call. What he doesn't know is that if you keep doing this and you keep doing prayer and meditation, you keep working with others, you're not going to be calling every day. God's going to watch your back. If you make it your mission to carry this message and help other drunks get sober, God doesn't want you jammed up with all sorts of resentment and fear. Think about it. This is new to me. I mean, this is new stuff to me. We never talked about this stuff. Never. You know, these contraband big books never made it through the door. I don't have enough time to talk about step 11. All I can say is if you ain't doing it, do it. It's the coolest thing in the world. Back in the 30s, these guys meditated way more than they prayed. God likes to hear from us, but he likes it better when he can get a word in edgewise. And that's what the meditation does. And you might not experience a burning bush or anything like that. However, when you go to that and you get quiet and you ask him to direct your thinking, those intuitive thoughts on that stuff that used to mystify us and baffle us, we'll know how to handle this stuff. And we'll find a deeper level of peace than we ever will when we pray. Just a suggestion. Working with the others they start the chapter with practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. Now, if this is what's going to keep people sober more than anything, why do we tell them that they have to wait a year or 2 years to do it? Think about it. Here, you got this problem, it's going to kill you, and you can have your solution in 11 and a half more months. If you make it. It means what it says. These guys back in the 30s, when the success rates were so high, all they were doing was taking the steps, looking for other drunks, and taking them through the work. They didn't have AA meetings. They couldn't do 90 and 90 because there weren't 90. All they did was go out and work with others and have these little meetings once a week where all they talk about, and you had to be recovered to talk, had to have taken the steps, they talked about how they're going to go find more drunks and how to better work with them. That's what the AA meetings were like, contrary to what some of the meetings are today. Anyway, it's probably a good time to stop, or we can keep going. 10 o'clock, anybody? Congratulations to the people that are celebrating tonight. That is real, real cool. Anyway, thank you for letting me share with you guys tonight. Hope I get out of here alive. I love you all.